The Second Crusade has failed, but its end will open the door to the Plantagenets, that brilliant, avaricious, rebellious, murderous family that will dominate the history of Western Europe for a century to come. Here's their story, so riveting that we still are fascinated by it 900 years later.
Welcome back to Lion's Forge. My name is Beckett, and I want to tell you a story, an epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 2, Episode 20, The World Cannot Hold. In the violent years 1187 and 1188, when everyone should have been setting out to recapture Jerusalem, French and English knights fought one another across the Aquitaine instead. The incessant battling over how to make peace would have been comical if lives and harvests weren't at stake. The worst of it happened in November 1188. Just as early hints of winter weather would normally make even the toughest fighting men appreciate the prospect of a truce. Everyone was sour and tense as talks dragged on, Henry and Richard holding separate rounds of meetings with Philip. The French king was careful to take Richard aside to share the latest rumors siphoned up by his spies, that brother John, who had not signed on to the new crusade, was being kept back by Henry, so that Henry could name John his heir as soon as Richard left for Syria. When the two sides next met, Philip again beat away on the drum of Richard's inheritance, publicly this time, announcing that he would return every square foot of Plantagenet land he had won, if Henry would publicly acknowledge Richard's demands, recognition of Richard as Henry's heir, and a speedy wedding to the long-neglected Elise. Henry refused. According to the chronicles, Philip asked again, just to be sure everyone was clear. Henry refused again. At this point, Richard said, with what mix of anger and frustration we can only guess, "I believe now what I couldn't believe before." Unstrapped his sword, handed it to Philip, and knelt, offering the King of France his personal fealty. The two mounted their great war horses and rode off together, leaving Henry standing alone, an old man stubbornly presiding over the wreckage of an empire he had spent a lifetime building. So things remained, festering, through the winter and into the lengthening days of the following spring. Messages were sent to Richard to meet with his father. Richard, as stubborn as Henry, as stubborn as Thomas Becket, sent the messengers back. Henry was confronted with news that Aquitanian nobles were traveling to kneel at Richard's feet. The Bretons rebelled. At last, the Pope intervened, incensed that this quarrel was interfering with what should have been active plans to organize a new crusade. In June 1189, a strong-minded papal legate named John arrived from Rome and excommunicated virtually everyone in Europe who was causing trouble, sparing Richard, Philip, and Henry. He may have held off on consigning them to damnation, but the papal pressure was weighty, and the two kings were forced to agree to arbitration. Everyone duly, if sullenly, set off in late May for the little town of La Ferté-Bernard, far to the southwest of Paris. It was a destination which perhaps made at least a few attendees cross themselves as they approached. The bordering river, the Huisne, was known to be the home of an alarmingly large and hairy dragon, with a bad temper and an unnerving habit of breathing clouds of fire. The conclave was well attended, what with two kings, Prince Richard, the papal legate, two French and two English archbishops, quite an assortment of lesser bishops, noblemen attending their liege lords, and the usual crowds of advisors, government officials, clerks, priests, messengers, and servants. Philip started off with his demands, which would have been recognizable back in his father's day, that Richard and Elise should be married immediately, and that Henry must formally recognize Richard as his heir. Philip sat down. Richard stood up. He repeated the same list, adding that he wanted a promise that if he were to subject himself to the very real risks of a crusade, his little brother John would go along, rather than be left behind, free to cause mischief at home. Richard sat down. Henry stood up. Being Henry, he basically said no to everything, but offered one of his typically undesirable alternatives, which was that poor Elise marry John. The papal legate, who had traveled from Rome to make everyone behave, no doubt watched the exchange with disbelief. Here was a conciliation conference that was rapidly going far, far off course. Trying to gather his wits, he demanded that Philip back off, or face the awful prospect of interdict across his kingdom. According to one report, Philip coolly answered that the only way this threat could have been even voiced was if a premeditated bribe had made its way in English silver from Henry to Legate John's hand. Needless to say, that was the end of this particular get-together, which probably degenerated into general name-calling and fistfights before everyone furiously rode off to go back to war. Henry Plantagenet was now 56 years old. We don't consider that a particularly great age, but we haven't been living and fighting in the saddle since we were 14. The chronicler William of Newburgh described him as sick to death of war. He was tired, physically and mentally. One of his biographers thinks he was in pain for years after a horse kicked him back in 1174 and broke his leg, an injury that healed badly and meant a hard life for someone often on horseback. His family was racked by death and anger. Half of his children, three of his five sons and his eldest daughter Matilda, were dead. His famous wife was nothing to him but a captive, his beloved Rosamund long gone. Richard hated him, and John was spoiled, nearly worthless. Richard and Philip set out together to besiege Henry's territory of Maine, tucked between Normandy and Anjou, peeling off its eastern castles. Nobles who owed fealty to Henry began to get nervous, thinking they might be better served kneeling at the younger men's feet. The king and a few loyalists, including his bastard son Geoffrey and the great William Marshal, headed to Le Mans, Maine's capital. Once, 1,000 years before, Le Mans had been the haunt of barbarians pushed aside by the Romans. Henry's ambitious, busy, unhappy parents had been married there, and he had been born in its businesslike stone palace. In the years since his mother and then Rosamund had died, Henry had spent more time in the walled city of his birth than he did in any other. One wonders if its streets, murmuring of 1,000 years of human striving, soothed him a bit as he faced his endless battles. Well, this fight would be the last. Men later telling each other that everything that happened to the old king came by way of his murder of Thomas Becket and his lifelong manipulation of his sons. Barely a week after the failed conference at La Ferté-Bernard, Philip and Richard reached Le Mans. Henry had the bridges over the Huisne burned, but Richard rode his war horse into the water with some of his knights, everyone sounding the river with their lances until they found a ford. A defensive fire, set outside the wooden walls by Henry's men in an effort to drive his son's army off, doubled back on the city. Henry escaped, accompanied by several hundred of his knights, by his bastard son Geoffrey, and a few barons. It's said that he paused on a hilltop a few miles from his birthplace and watched it burn, cursing God for taking
the city I loved best in all the world,
swearing he'd find a way to keep his immortal soul out of the hands of his uncaring creator. William Marshall covered his king's retreat, chancing upon an unarmed Richard in an overeager pursuit. The story is that Marshall, the greatest of all knights, killed Richard's horse while letting the prince live, legendarily becoming the only man ever to unhorse Lionheart. It's been believed down the centuries that he screamed at Richard, "Let the devil kill you, for I will not," as he rode back to join his king. Henry wandered as if in a daze, first riding north toward Normandy and England, respite, help, safety. Then suddenly, he turned south, making for his ancestral lands in Anjou. As he rode on and on, city after city fell to the combined forces of Richard and Philip. They took Le Mans. They took Tours. When Henry finally met with the exuberant young French king at a small hunting lodge owned by the Knights Templar in the little town of Ballen, the old man was obviously exhausted and in pain. Even Philip was moved to offer Henry a seat on his cloak, which Henry waved off. Instead, he stayed stubbornly in the saddle, supported by his knights, as Philip laid out terms. He wanted nothing less than Henry's abject admission of defeat, followed by his sworn homage, before Philip would even begin to discuss an end to the destruction. The chronicler Roger of Hoveden wrote, in one of those wonderful old stories that probably isn't true, that the Ballen negotiation took place on a clear July day under blue skies. As the kings faced each other, thunder rumbled across the sky, and a spear of summer lightning slammed into the ground between their horses. Frightened, the animals reared back. The riders spurred them forward. Thunder again burst from a perfectly cloudless summer sky. Then, what happened in the next hours is thought to be true. Henry collapsed, falling from his horse. Completely spent, he accepted all the brutal terms that Philip dictated. Homage, cash payments, great castles, Elise's wedding, recognition of Richard's rights in all Plantagenet lands, release of the barons from their obligations to any saved Richard. Last but not least, Henry was to give Richard the kiss of peace, which he did, although it was rumored that he retained enough raw Plantagenet grit to add a whispered prayer that God would yet give him sufficient life and strength to get his revenge. The old king, who had ridden tens of thousands of miles in his lifetime, could no longer mount his horse. He was carried on a litter to Chinon, one of his favorite homes, the site of so many Plantagenet holidays. They put him to bed, an old warrior, ashen-faced with the effort to master his pain. Before leaving hateful Ballen and his humiliation at Philip's hands, Henry had asked the names of the barons who had abdicated their allegiance to him in the days before. The list arrived. The first name on it was his beloved youngest son's, who had cravenly knelt to his warrior brother, breaking faith with his adoring father. They say that Henry turned his face to the wall after that and lay there shaking with fever, drifting in and out of a coma, sometimes muttering to himself,
"Shame, shame." Shame upon a conquered king.
There are various stories about his last days. Some say that he died alone, except for a few servants who shamelessly rifled his belongings and left the old man's corpse naked on its deathbed. Cosmic payback for everything from Becket's murder to years of so much familial bitterness and war. Others, hopefully more accurate, put a few loyal supporters at his side, his illegitimate son Geoffrey holding his dying father's head against his shoulder hour after hour, William Marshall and the Earl of Essex steadfast in the room. Those better stories go on to say that after several days of mingled delirium and calm, Henry took off a gold ring bearing his crest and gave it to steadfast Geoffrey, the only son who never deserted him. Then he took another from his finger and asked Geoffrey to send it to his son-in-law, King Alfonso VIII of Castile, married to Henry and Eleanor's daughter, also named Eleanor. Assuming this story is true, it's interesting that Henry would single out his son-in-law on his deathbed. One could say that Henry had reason enough to have given up on his own sons, while Alfonso had backed his father-in-law during the war in the Limousin. Then, too, Henry may have seen his better self in the ambitious younger man, who experienced both great setbacks and great success in his lifelong effort to unite the little kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula against the Saracens. Soon after, he was taken to the stone-walled chapel of Chinon Castle. It was the 6th day of July, 1189. In Europe, the greatest lion of them all was dead. Far to the east, the Arab warrior king named Saladin had taken control of the holiest city in Christendom. The world itself could not hold. As Ecclesiastes wrote of human life, "Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had spent in doing it. And behold, all was vanity, and a striving after the wind."
So we end Season 2 of Lion's Forge. When we meet again, it will be to watch Richard Lionheart play his role as King of England and hero of the Third Crusade.
We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again September 2nd for the start of the next chapter of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.